quite humble roots with a Hillman Husky floor plan.
I see what you did there. Very good.
Didn't actually mean that. But then they were hopelessly unreliable.
Yeah, of course they were hopelessly. It's British. Of course they were hopelessly unreliable.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show, a verbal VTech of a podcast, a double overhead camshaft of classic car conversation. I'm Phil Whedon. I'm joined by my regular co-host, Joe Miller.
Hello.
And Jeff Ruggles.
Hello.
Does that mean the podcast is going to get more nailed and exciting the further into it we get?
Yeah, it's going to get more obscure, isn't it? Choosing our scheduling wisely here to navigate various summer holiday commitments, but we are here reporting on the copy of Classic Car Buyer that came out 2 days earlier, so Wednesday's paper. So it's still on sale to this day if you want to go and grab yourself a copy. But Jeff, what is our headline story this week?
Well, I mean, it's been bubbling up for about a week, but it couldn't be anything but the National Motor Museum Trust poised to leave Bewley. There's been a car museum at Bewley for 74 years. The museum has been in its current building since 1972. So this is fairly monumental. Fairly monumental. We understand that on the current premises is not being renewed and expires in 2030. So the National Motor Museum Trust, which is separate from the Bewley Estate, is taking the opportunity to move to a different premises, which it says will, you know, will help it develop, will help it be more educational, you know, will help it perform its role as a museum, but also will have things like a potential for a heritage skills academy. So it could be potentially very exciting. It's just, obviously, the news is quite a shock because, you know, the National Motor Museum is at Bewley. You don't expect it to be anywhere else. We understand that the Montague family will keep the cars that it possesses, and the rest of the collection owned by the trust will move on.
It's enormous news. I mean, I would imagine I'm quite a lot younger than most of our listeners and viewers, but I remember going there since I was a kid. You know, it's such a... not to overuse a phrase, but it's an institution. You know, it's wonderful.
It is. And as far as I understand, the events will continue at the Bewley location. There will be no changes for the next 4 years. The trust will continue as it is. So we'll have to see what happens. The only thing I can say is that obviously we wish all the best to the staff and the volunteers, and we hope their livelihoods are not affected.
The moving of all of that collection and everything that comes with it will not be a small undertaking by any means. So, yeah, we just wish them all the best with it and hope they all figure it out. So, yes, very good. Now, I wanted to just read through some of the comments from our most recent podcast as of recording, which was the one about the 1986 fleet manager. But crucially, at the start of that, we talked about should you or should you not modify a classic. And it was really good because it threw up a lot of interesting opinions, I would say. A lot of people aligned with Joe's thoughts about being able to reverse a modification. Some people were just dead against it, which is safe to say. But others were very open to the idea of it being a sympathetic modification that made it more usable in modern traffic. As the owner of too many cars, I'm not adverse to modifying cars, but like to keep the changes to period-appropriate modifications, says one listener here. And I like to keep the upgrades so that they can come from the same manufacturer, especially when it comes to engine swaps. That's an interesting thought, isn't it? So,
I like that.
Yes, we actually have an engine swap feature coming up in Classic Car Buyer. So, yeah.
Well, as our resident Mini man, Jeff, you can probably well relate to that because Minis is one of those cars that has always been subject to engine modifications and engine swaps, isn't it? So,
I can, and I have this debate with my own Mini, which is obviously 850cc. I'm sort of fighting the urge to put a 1275 engine in because I feel that people don't give me enough time. We've got a lot of big, very powerful accelerating electric cars now on the road. And maybe it's debate for another day, but they don't afford me the patience on the road that 34 horsepower perhaps equates to needing.
Yeah.
And I find that when I drive my other Mini, which is 75 horsepower, don't have those issues.
Yeah, there is an element of that.
And then again, you've got people who drive around happily in Austin 7, so I could be talking nonsense. It's just that from my own personal experience, I want to upgrade it a little bit so I can make it a bit more usable.
It's interesting you say about the engine, because actually the brakes is also the other thing that comes up for scrutiny, particularly if you've got a classic with drum brakes all round. People just don't allow braking distance thing. They'll not only overtake you, they'll then cut back in and then brake all of a sudden, and you've got double the braking distance required to slow you up.
Where do you draw the line? Because there's things like, could you retrofit ISOFIX for a child seat, for instance? You're able to take out the younger generation in that classic and appeal to a wider range of people. So where do you stop and say, actually, I can't do that?
I maintain my point on reversibility, because there are certain things. I mean, take, for example, electronic ignition. That's a very common modification, even among people who will do absolutely nothing else in terms of mods, because it makes it better objectively without actually affecting anything. And, you know, I've had countless comments on things I've done to my Fiat of, oh, you've ruined that. I'm like, yeah, but if I try it for a while and decide I don't like something I've done, it's only nuts and bolts. You know, even those bucket seats I've come for a lot of flack in, because I did a nearly 5-hour journey in the yesterday and I've got a slightly numb backside. But actually, if I decide down the line that I hate them, it's 4 bolts, you know, and I can put another seat in it. I think provided, like I said before, provided you're not cutting the bulkhead out and, you know, grinding away bits of the arches to make things fit, go nuts, do whatever you want. I think you've got to experiment with these things, because heaven forbid, you might make it better.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of element. It's your car. You can do what you want. But, you know, not everyone will share that view. And I do sympathize with your view. With my Mini, for instance, I'll be making everything very much under the radar and reversible. So I think that's the way forward if you want a bit more practicality and usability but without losing the character.
Yeah, I think there's room for both. I mean, I don't know about you. I personally, I like washing my clothes in a washing machine, but that's not traditional, you know, so it's, you know, where do you draw the line with some of these things?
Well, I'm glad to hear you're clean.
Yeah.
I think on that basis, I would recommend parking sensors as a modification, because that is certainly helping your reversibility. So that's what I would go with that.
Very good. Yes, very good.
I think safe to say the subject of modifications we'll definitely come back to, because we had Jamie King on that particular podcast. And Jeff, I think you've got probably a decent amount of experience of modifications, as indeed of you, Joe, with your Sorento, as we've said. So listen, keep those comments coming, and we will return to this topic in due course. Now, gents, on to our buying roundup, if we may, because we've had a glorious run of sunny weather this summer, quite unlike a British summer. It's actually been quite persistently sunny, and it's lovely. I think we should all celebrate. So this gives us a good excuse to talk about sporting roadsters, actual proper sports cars. So I don't want any coupes. We've already done coupes. I want sporty drop top. So I'm not even thinking about 4-seater cabriolets or anything like that. I want to go unashamed sports cars. Ones that we can drop the roof with the sun shining and go and hammer down our favorite B road or whatever. And I've suggested we go with 3 different budget points. We'll go with a sort of a sub 5K one. That's nice and approachable. Then we'll spend up to about 20K, and then we'll go money, no object. And I think it'll be surprising how down to earth we are, even with our money, no object choices. But let's see.
We also try to experiment as ever. It's worth noting that we don't want to just have the same choices every time, because it would be very easy. It's sort of become a running joke at this point that I pick the TVR Chimera for everything, you know, and the various other cars that seem to keep coming up. So we do try to have some variety in these as well.
Indeed. So Jeff, kick us off, sir.
So it might be a stretch under 5K, and you don't so much as put the roof down as remove it, but it's the Fiat X19.
Ooh.
Which I'm a big fan of. Like to rust. It was a concept car, wasn't it? It was the Auto Bianchi concept. It's a concept about 1969, I think. And then they, Bertone and Fiat, they put it into production. Very simple mechanicals from the Fiat 128. The perfect kind of wedge shape.
So elegant, yeah.
I like the later cars as well, with the bigger bumpers and the 1500 engine and the 5-speed box. But an early one would just be my perfect choice of a period sort of 70s sports car. Quite modest, still affordable. I don't think you'd get an early one for under 5K, but you might get a later 1500 version with a few rust issues.
They've all got a few rust issues.
Yeah, but maybe, I mean, some time ago, I was searching the classified ads abroad, as I seem to waste most of my life doing. And I think there was a red 1300 with black bumpers and these big sort of Cromodora alloys. Just incredible.
You've driven one, haven't you, Joe? You drove one at Hobbs.
I did. It was in the pitting rain in an industrial estate, and still it was hilarious fun. They are fantastic cars, and
yeah,
it's one of those fun any speeds kind of cars. So yeah, Jeff, I applaud that. Do you know what?
Yeah.
My choice comes in under budget, so you can have some of my budget to buy one if you want.
Very good. All right then, Joe. What's your bargain basement buy?
Regular viewers and listeners will know about my Porsche obsession in the last few months. And also those of us with mortgages will know that my 997 dream is not going to happen anytime soon. However, there is, of course, the poor man's 911 is the Boxster. The 986 Porsche Boxster is my first nomination, which has got to be one of the bargains of the moment. I've watched examples of this go through BCA for a bit over 1,500 quid. And if you go on Facebook Marketplace or eBay now, you'll find a roadworthy 2.5 or 2.7 for $3,500 or so. For our $5,000 budget, you'll even get into a 3.2S. And what you've got is this fabulous mid-engine chassis, proper flat six. This isn't a 924 where it was technically a Volkswagen. This is a proper mid-engine rear drive Porsche sports car from the ground up. From the front half forward, it's a 996 911, a proper Porsche sports car. They handle brilliantly. The aftermarket support for parts is excellent. Porsche have now given it classic status, so you can get bits from Porsche for the thing. And yet, they will do 40 to the gallon on a run. The insurance is less than some hot hatches. There's plenty of them out there. They seem to be bulletproof reliable. They don't really seem to rust. I think for less than $5,000, the 986 Boxster is one of the bargains at the moment.
Can't argue with that. And actually, they've hit a sort of trough, if you like, and kind of stayed there for a while. I was kind of expecting the uptick to happen anytime soon.
Yeah, sure, let's keep quiet about that. We'll not encourage anything.
So let's get in on it while we can. Tell me about looking after one, though, Joe. You probably looked into this more than I have, but Porsche maintenance always scares me a bit. I always sort of think that, are the parts going to be more expensive?
The thing is with the Boxster is it's not actually that exotic. You know, it's not a 911 GT3 or a turbo or anything like that. You can buy your oils and your filters and your fluids from Euro Car Parts and do it yourself. You know, by the time you're underneath the thing, it's no harder to service than any other front or rear engine car.
And the technology exists now as well, doesn't it, to do the IMS.
Exactly.
And your rear main seal. You know, you can get up. They were troublesome on certain years, I think, but you can get the bits to now.
The 2.5s in particular don't really suffer with the IMS anyway. So if you're that bothered about it, go for a 2.5. The only other thing that is worth watching is they do suffer with, like so many convertibles, the drain holes for the hood get clogged. You end up with water going into the car. It ends up in the passenger's footwell, which is where all the ECUs and all the modules are. So if you're looking at a really cheap Boxster and it's got random electrical gremlins, like windows don't work and roof doesn't go down, just check the carpet. Because if it's flooded and killed all those modules, you can very quickly write the car off. But buy carefully, and I think you've got an absolute bargain in the 986 Boxster, and I really do want one. And again, they come in so much under budget, Jeff, that if you can't get your X19 for $5,000, you can have some of my leftover if you like.
Right, if you want to give me a couple of grand, go ahead, lad.
Very good. Well, my first choice is also similarly modern, and it's the MGTF. So basically the coil-sprung, facelifted MGF from about, 2002? I'm perhaps always influenced by the fact that we ran one for a few years, and I remember absolutely loving it. And a controversial take here, I think I prefer the TF to the F.
What makes you... I was just going to ask, why did you go TF over F?
I prefer the facelifted styling, for one. And actually, everyone says the Hydrogas is better, a better compromise with ride and handling, and they're probably right. But actually, I quite like the darty kind of coil-sprung bounce of the TF. And yeah, I just think what's not to like? They're such fun, really. And although I'm now talking about an early noughties car, I think they've got a feel of a sort of an 80s or a 90s classic. So they feel quite old, but in a good way. Do you know what I mean? They've got quite an analog appeal to them.
They're a 90s car at heart, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just browsing before we joined the call, and there was one from a dealer with, it's a metallic grey, 2004, 60,000 miles or 69,000 miles. And it was up for $2,000 or $3,000. Just so affordable. And then here's the thing. All the things you're scared about, head gaskets, blah, blah, blah. All of the parts are available, well supported at club level. So you've got all the benefit of a traditional classic as well, because it's just, there's an abundance of parts. That K-Series engine appeared in everything from a Rover R8 to a Caterham. So parts availability for the engine and everything else is second to none. So what's not to like?
Great choice. I think that defines bargain.
Yes. Absolutely. So Jeff, round two. Up to $20,000, this one.
A little bit bonkers. Kind of inspired by the guy across the road having one. I can kind of just about see it. It's the BMW Z3. When the Z3 came out, even with the 2.8, some people complained it was a little bit lackluster. So BMW responded by putting the E36 M3 engine in to create the Z3M. And I think the early ones didn't even have any traction control or anything like that. So a little bit crazy, but they look so good. The later ones, of course, got the S54 engine and the stability control DSC. So they're probably a little bit more manageable. But the idea of an early unhinged Z3M. Of course, you can have the Z3M Coupe as well, but of course, we're focusing on Roadsters here. So the Roadster will be lovely, a nice early one. I reckon I've seen them from as little as about £13,000. You can spend sort of 16 on a good one, and some people have them up for 35. So it really depends on condition, I think. But within budget, it's just about possible.
I think that's a proper factory muscle car, that this tiny little Z3 with that hugely powerful M3 engine in it. I think they're fantastic.
The simple E30 derived rear suspension. What could possibly go wrong?
I think it's a great choice. I think the styling's fantastic. I think it's aimed really well. It was always a bit distinctive.
If you're going to have a bonnet that big, why not have a powerful engine to really complement it?
Quite right.
And again, because it's like an E30/E36 3 Series underneath, like a bit of a, you know, parts bin classic type stuff underneath, getting parts for it's probably pretty straightforward as well. I applaud your choice. Yes, I think we can all highly commend it. So Joe's going to go and gazumpus now, is he?
I'm going to try. So if you think 90s Roadster driver's choice, we've covered the Z3M, we've covered the Boxster. TVR Camaro is off limits because I picked that for everything, including family hatchbacks. So I'm going with the driver's choice, gentlemen, the Lotus Elise, which you will get for a 20 grand budget. The mid-engine masterpiece from Hethel. Obviously, the earlier ones were the K-Series powered cars. Then they went to the Toyota. Then they did supercharged ones, all kinds of blurry things. But there's nothing superfluous to an Elise. You have a seat, a steering wheel, an engine, the best suspension and chassis engineering in the world because it's Lotus. And what you get is the most wonderful driving experience on road or track. It's not actually blisteringly quick, but it's fast enough to be exciting. And it's brilliant. I dare anyone to find a better chassis anywhere for any amount of money than a Lotus Elise. There's a reason why it's a legend. And you can get them for less than 20 grand. They're very well supportive of bits because so much of it is parts bin. And even the fiberglass repairs needn't write them off anymore. There are people that can repair whole body shells and the clamshells for them or whatever. And the scenery and low tie is so tight-knit and so enthusiastic that any problem you do have, there'll be someone that can help you out with it anyway. If you can afford one, it's also a depreciation-proof car. It's the kind of car you can buy it for 20 grand now, keep it for 5 years, and sell it for what you paid for it. Free motoring in one of the best sports cars ever made. Sign me up.
It's 30 years old, and yet it's aged so perfectly, isn't it?
I would like to have aged as well as the Elise has by the time I reach 30, but I doubt it, sadly. Yeah.
Given how your knees were creaking on our Wednesday photo, yes. I suspect not. But anyway, good choice. A very good choice. Yes, very strong contender as one of those sort of peak cars from that sort of mid to late 90s period, which generated a lot of good cars at that era, I would suggest.
Yes, but, indeed. Go on then. What can you offer up to that?
Well, it's my only probably trad choice of the three, actually, because I've gone with Triumph TR6. And I should just put a slight government health warning. I shocked myself when I was looking for them and realised that actually quite a few are now over £20,000. Well-restored examples are now over 20. But you can still get them for under 20.
Yes.
I love the TR6. I think it's a really nice sort of blend of that traditional British sports car. It's got the lovely engine in it. I think it looks good. You can do, again, we talked about modifications at the start of the podcast. There's some sympathetic upgrade you can do. A lot of people put like Mazda MX-5 seats in them to make them a bit more comfortable on longer journeys. As a traditional choice, I think a Triumph TR6 takes a lot of beating. And values, you know, they look like they're going up in certain quarters, but I've remember TR6s being around the 15 grand mark for quite some time, and you can still buy them for 15 to 20. So
yeah, I think you still can. In fact, probably at the bottom end, actually, it probably softened a little bit. I mean, yes, the very best cars will go past 20,000 with relative ease, but I think it's probably easier to get into a TR6 than it has been for some time.
The other thing is, I think they drive so well because they've got, there's more to them than the likes of an MGB. You know, they feel a bit bigger, they've got more torque and everything else, but they don't beat you up like a big Healey or an XK120 does. They're actually a very easy car to drive quickly. I mean, go and watch the road test video on the channel if you haven't, because I think they're wonderful cars. Yeah, I can't argue with that at all.
I'm glad we're all massive consensus here so far. So Jeff's going to wow us with his third and final choice.
Yeah,
third and final object.
This is a car that I've never driven, I'll confess. And the only sort of encounter I've had one is writing about one that got nicked. The car I have picked is the Sunbeam Tiger.
Ooh.
We spoke about the Elise, didn't we? And you hark back to the Elan of the 1960s, light, really making the most of a lightweight fiberglass body and a small punchy engine. Well, there's more than one way to crack a nut, isn't there? And the Sunbeam Tiger took that nut and then smashed it to bits with a sledgehammer. Obviously, based on the Sunbeam Alpine, which itself has quite humble roots with a Hillman Husky floor pan.
Yeah, roots. See what you did there. Very good.
Didn't actually mean that. Based on the something Alpine, humble roots, Hillman Husky floor pan, but actually quite an advanced car for its time, except for the fact that for the American market, it was seen as too slow. As far as we know, there were two prototypes built. Engine space was measured using a wooden yardstick, and people hunted around for a V8 that would fit. They eventually sort of hit upon the Ford V8, and I believe Ken Miles built a prototype and Shelby American built a prototype, and the Shelby American one was chosen. Shelby American didn't actually build the cars, that was Jensen, but basically from 64 in the States to 65 here, you've got a 4.3-litre V8 powered Alpine with the Tiger.
What's not to like about that?
Brilliant. Exactly. Rack and pinion steering, a fairly burly roadster with a big engine. And what's not to like about that, as you say? The engine got bigger for the Mark II, 4.7. But then when Chrysler got involved with Roots, you couldn't really have a Ford engine in one of your cars. So that was the end of the line, really. But that's why they're rare, exclusive, 50 to 70 grand, maybe.
Ooh.
On a Mark II, especially. But
they're really rather wonderful, though. I think that's a great choice.
It would demand commitment to drive it properly, for sure. Yeah. But then if you're buying that kind of car, that's surely what you want.
Yeah.
It's a really good sort of underplayed choice. You know, there are many more obvious cars from that era. So I love the fact you've gone for a slightly left field option.
I might be insane, but we'll see.
I think that's fabulous.
Joe, your third and final choice.
So going down a similar kind of vein, it's British, it's late 50s, early 60s, and it is something that, again, if you could commit to it, all the rewards come. My choice is the MGA, but specifically the twin cam, which you could get as a roadster. And again, this is another take on the cracking of the nut of small car, big power, because you don't get a big British V8. It's still only an early B-series engine, but with the twin cam head on it, you've got well over 100 horsepower in this thing. And when you think the MGA is actually it's a deceptively tiny car, it's not much bigger than a midget, and it weighs next to nothing. You've got a well over 100 mile an hour car. The acceleration by the standard of the day is rapid, on par with a Lotus Elan in some cases. The sound is phenomenal, and the MGA chassis is well ahead of its time. It's a proper vintage sports car experience. You sort of steer it from the shoulders and let the tires drift out just to the edge. It's got this lovely, playful chassis. You can hang your elbow out like you're driving in Le Mans back in the 50s. And yeah, I think they're wonderful things. It's small wonder why they command £40,000-£50,000 for the best. But there are a few British sports cars that are as exciting, as much fun, and actually still impressively quick. And again, you go out and drive one of those fast for a few hours, you're going to be tired at the end of it, but you're going to have had the time of your life. I think they're brilliant things.
Are we going to address the elephant in the room?
What's that?
Well, then they were hopelessly unreliable.
Yeah, of course they were hopelessly. It's British. Of course they were hopelessly unreliable.
Although the production run was short, the knowledge and the technology these days exists, like so many cars.
Yes.
Make them fabulous.
Yes, exactly. You know,
to make them reliable. But I suppose at the time, very forward thinking, wasn't it, from MG?
Definitely.
Maybe that caught them out a little bit, but great, great looking car. Great looking engine, to be fair.
Yeah, actually. The styling of the MGA for me is still utterly timeless. I mean, like I said before, you could put an Alfa or a Maserati badge on the front of that, and I don't think it would look out of place. I think it's gorgeous.
It's probably MG's prettiest ever vehicle, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd go with that 100%.
Yeah, I'd agree with that too. I think the MGA, great choice. For my third and final choice, I could have gone with Jaguar E-Type, but as Joe said earlier, we were trying to avoid just saying the same cars every time a top three comes up.
So you've gone for the TVR Chimera.
Yes, but I was influenced by a recent road test that I did, and that is a Porsche 997 Cabriolet. Is it a roadster when it's like that? I don't know. It's still a drop top, and it's still a sports car, so I'm going with it. I drove this one. Joe and I went to see a Porsche specialist, Ashgood, a few weeks ago, and I got to drive their 997.2 Cabriolet. I just thought it was lovely. I think it was up for about 60 grand, which I don't think it's too bad in Porsche world. I'm obviously coming very much from a Jaguar prism where things are a little bit perhaps softer and a bit more compliant, a bit more grand tour-y. But the 911 in that guise was just lovely. And it was in the silver and the black alloys. I just think it looked really understated.
Classy, yeah.
Engaging to drive. I could see myself driving at 5/10 down a quiet road or 9/10 down a sort of autobahn or something. it would do all of those things and much, much more. The 997 takes a lot of beating, I would say.
With that 997 video, you'll see coming soon on the channel, because obviously the purist would say, or me, for example, would say you want two-wheel drive, manual coupe. And this car that Phil drove was a four-wheel drive, automatic cabriolet. So it's everything the enthusiast says not to choose. And the whole point was to find it, is it still worth having? And as you can tell by the fact Phil's kept his cards very close to his chest, you'll have to watch the video to find out.
Exactly that. Exactly that. Well, look, do let us know in the comments, guys. There's an infinite choice. We could have almost done it sports roadsters of the 60s and just stuck it to a decade. But we had 60-odd years worth of cars to sort of choose from, as well as three different budget points. So there's probably loads and loads of suggestions that you can put in the comments and let us know. And perhaps give us the most outlandish one you can find. Go and search on classifieds and give us a £1 million roadster that you'd like to do as your money no object one. So I hope we've inspired a few choices there. But what have we got coming up in the near future, chaps? We're filming this slightly out of kilter, but yes, stuff you've got looking forward to in the weekend ahead or the near future. So, Jeff?
Well, I'm currently in France.
Honestly, it looks a lot like your loft, actually.
It does, doesn't it? Isn't that weird? I'm currently in France. I'm currently, well, hopefully, if I got there. So I plan to spend the weekend in France, or possibly into Switzerland. I think today I'm in Switzerland, actually. And then tomorrow it'll be a nice tour of some of the wine towns like Colmar and Riquier and places like that. So hopefully that'll be very nice in my classic Mini, which I'm sure has reliably got me there.
Well, we look forward to seeing photos of that, Jeff, in a future podcast. So watch this space. And what about you, Joe?
Looking ahead on the timeline, this weekend coming, as we film this, I will be at Silverstone Ford Fair. I'm looking forward to it. For me, Ford Fair has just gone from strength to strength over the years. And we've heard all the running jokes that it's all just Fiesta STs. The truth is, it isn't. The variety just gets better and better. And some of the stuff we've had in recent years, last year's show had an Escort, a Pullman, I think it's called, which is like a wheelchair adapted one. And there's been Mark II Granadas there and countless RS Turbos and Cosworths and all that kind of thing. So don't assume that if you're only into your old stuff, there's nothing for you at Ford Fair. I'm looking forward to it. And again, touch wood, if the weather holds form, it's going to be another great one. So yeah, Ford's for me, as the not a Ford man, as I always say.
Nothing wrong with the Fiesta ST, Joe.
Well, I'm going to be there as well, Joe, with you, and very much looking forward to it. We're obviously, as we did with Classic Ford Show earlier in the year, be marking 50 years of the Fiesta. So we've put together, I think, 50 Fiestas, but this time ranging from Mark 1 through to Mark 8. I'm looking forward to that display. There are many, many other Fords of all generations going to be there. Hopefully one of our biggest Blue Oval celebrations yet.
Yeah, I can miss that one, to be honest.
Yes. Well, you'll be busy driving through some beautiful European countryside. So,
well, there is a slight silver lining, I suppose. Yeah.
Yes. One day,
to interject very quickly, talking of Fiestas, are we right in thinking that your dear little white one has departed now, Jeff?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a shame. Yeah. Breaking news, the little import Fiesta has gone, which is a shame. We all like that car.
Do go and check the collection caper video on the channel. Jeff doesn't just go to the local classic car dealer and pick up a Fiesta. He drives to the south of France to do it. So, yes.
Next time for a new adventure now.
I think so.
You go soon, Cub.
We mentioned Triumph TR6s earlier. That gives me a chance to do our shameless weekly Bookazine push, which is we've got a series of products called the Best of British Leyland, which I know for some people will seem a contradiction of terms, but we did a Best of British Leyland on Triumph, all things Triumph. So if you love to celebrate that particular sporting mark, then do go and check out this Bookazine. It celebrates all models, saloons and sports cars. Go and check it out. We'll put a link in the description.
There might even be some TR6 in there.
Well, yeah, hopefully I can get some buying advice before I go and buy one. But we should try and wrap up with our final bit, which is, of course, our want of the week. So, Jeff, what man maths have you been constructing this week?
So some time ago, I was quite shocked to learn it was 2013. I was offered a Honda Accord Type R for £800.
What?
For £800. Now, I will caveat, the person that did buy it blew it up within about 30 minutes. So there was probably some serious issues with it. But I haven't been able to get the idea of buying a Honda Accord Type R out of my head ever since. And we did a little market trends piece on them in the last issue of the CCB. And you can still buy them quite cheaply. It was sort of around $4,000 to $7,000.
See, in the world of Japanese cars, that's nothing.
Yeah, and when you consider what an Integra Type R is, or even an EP3 Civic Type R, that seems quite affordable for a family chariot that does go very well and handle very well.
Mm.
So, you know, and I'm very much a fan of 90s Super Touring era BTCC. So, you know, quite like the idea of one, really.
I really like them. I love the interior, actually, of that generation of Accord.
The sort of green Recaro.
Mm. Yeah, bang for buck. Very good.
Great call.
What about you, Joe?
So, as you detailed earlier, Phil, obviously we're in the throes of one of the best summers we've had for years. Glorious sunshine, 30-degree heat. I can't remember the last time it rained, which means naturally I'm thinking about 4x4s and knobbly, gnarly off-roaders, because now is the time to buy, because no one's buying them at the moment. And specifically, it's one I've always, always, always wanted, and they're still cheap, and yes, they rot like billy-o, but they're fabulous. The Suzuki Jimny. I've been looking at Jimnys a lot, and I've even found one for sale on good old Facebook Marketplace. There you go, I'll show it to the camera. It's a 2003 model. It's done 150,000 miles. However, two things are significant about that. Number one, it's got no rot on the MOT history. And number two is it's got one owner from new, which is a little old man and his wife, who only used it for driving to the shop. It's never been off-road. It's never been used in the winter. It's
where was the shop? The shop must be quite away for 150,000 miles.
It's driven to a lot of shops. But it's $2,000. And I think a Jimny for $2,000 that's not been off-roaded to death and covered in big knobbly tires and lift kits and snorkels. And I can do it. I can ruin it. That's fine. But no one else has done the ruining. And that's the main thing. And I love Jimnys. They've got that real mountain goat character to them. And they are what the Panda 4x4 was back when Panda 4x4s were affordable. I'll be ready. When the rain comes, I'll be ready.
I love the idea of getting a Suzuki Jimny with the roof bar. Put a roof box on it and then go exploring.
Adventuring.
Yeah. Really good fun. I think they're quite bouncy. I put up with that. I like the chunky styling and
yeah, brilliant. They're great.
What's not to like about that? We've gone long and I've still not mentioned Jaguar. So now's the time, chaps. I've got a choice of two here, and I just wanted to. This is kind of more an indication of sort of a buying dilemma if you're a Jaguar obsessive like me. So it's 10 years ago that I sold my Jaguar S Type R. So having ticked that box, naturally, I now just want to go and buy one. I started looking at S-Type R's, and 7 to 10, you can still buy them. Ideally, I'd buy a pre-06 one, so to avoid the ruinous road tax here in the UK. But I did find one, and we'll put it up on the screen, in black. I think it was up for $7,995. Looked a lovely example in black with the dark interior and the alley inserts in the dashboard. But for not much more, or roughly in the same wheelhouse, you can also now get a Jaguar XE 3-litre supercharged V6. So now you're going like you're leaping ahead of generation.
So two generations, yeah. That engine is a masterpiece, though. That V6, fabulous.
The XE 3-litre V6S is basically a four-door F-type, if you think about it. And they're not as ruinous on the tax in the UK, because I think it's a 450 quid offering rather than 790 or something. So I started to justify it to myself purely on the basis that it's a cheaper to run F-type and I can put the kids in the back. So that's my want of the week.
We are seeing man maths playing out here, ladies and gentlemen.
Of course. But anyway, well, we should probably wrap up, because that was a very long and exotic podcast, but thoroughly enjoyable. To viewers and listeners at home, as ever, thank you very much for all your continued support. Do please spread the word. Tell your other classic car obsessive friends about the Classics World chat show and get involved. Put comments, like, subscribe to a little rating or review on a podcast platform of choice, and stay tuned, because we'll be here every Friday. So thanks again for watching and listening, and we'll catch you next time. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.